Well, happy Father's Day. I know it's getting late in the day, but still not too late to wish you a happy Father's Day. Don't know if any of you fathers received a card or if you gave a card to your dad. Rosemary actually gave me a copy of the re-release of the CD of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which was really cool because it's 50 years ago. And if you're as old as me, you remember when it first came out. It's top the charts again. So, but maybe you received a Father's Day gift, and if you didn't, I had a quick look online to see what you could give as a Father's Day gift. And here are a few things. Make your own chorizo sausage kit. World's best dad craft beer chocolates. Private table tennis masterclass for two. How about that? A three-month Friday night curry subscription. Now, that's pretty good. Or the essential new wine accessory, a personalised camping mallet. But Father's Day is a day that may evoke a heart of thankfulness in some of us. For others, it may evoke pain, hurt. For others, it may just be kind of numb or neutral. But I think wherever you sit, you know, on that spectrum, God has placed something within us all, a desire, a longing to be loved, to be valued. And it's designed into us by God himself. It's intrinsic to who we are, to the way we're made. And C.S. Lewis, if you ever read his sermon, The Weight of Glory, talks about it this way, this sense of longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they're mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshippers. For they're not the thing itself. They're only a scent, the scent of a flower we've not found, the echo of a tune we've not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. And our readings talk of blessing, the heart of God and the heart of the Old Testament patriarchs. God blessing Jesus at his baptism, and Isaac and Jacob blessing their sons and their grandsons. And I'm sure if you're a father like me, or grandfather, like a friend Rich here too, I'm sure your heart is too for your sons to receive that blessing. But our experience can sometimes bury that or fracture it, can't it? And maybe at times it'll surface just to be buried again. Perhaps moments like that are what we dream about, but never seem to happen, whether you're a father or whether you're a son or a daughter. You never get to feel that sense of blessing. Just want to show you a short clip. Those of you that like The Incredibles might like this. This is the piece when Dash is in the 400-meter race. It's a very short clip, so watch it quick.
That's
my boy. So, do you hear what Mr. Incredible says? That's my boy. And you can see just the delight in his heart at Dash. Now, Dash could, if you know the film The Incredibles, you know The Incredibles. He's kind of quick, isn't he, Dash? But he paced it, come second, and he does that, and that's my boy. And that's just something, it's a slightly sideways look, I know, but that's something just of the ecstasy of the father. But we find ourselves too, contrary to that, as a nation, and I'm sure as individuals, shattered by the events of the last 3 months. Three terrorist attacks, fire in Grenfell House in the early hours of Wednesday morning this week. And perhaps to talk of blessing can seem a little bit insensitive at this time. And I think there are events that have wrenched our hearts this week. So where is God in all this? Where is blessing? Well, in the time that we've got just together this evening, what I'd like to do is take us back to a story that Jesus tells in Luke chapter 15. What I'd like you to do is Luke 15:11-32. don't worry necessarily about looking at it now, but I would encourage you, before you go to bed tonight, just spend a few minutes reading it. Now, in the Bible, you'll see there's a little note that says, the parable of the lost son. What I'd like to do is just turn it round slightly in terms of emphasis this evening and call it the parable of the running father. And I want to show you just a glimpse of a father in that story who's so passionate for his love for his sons that he's willing to break all the cultural norms of his day. And as you know the story, you have the younger son comes to the father and says, Father, give me my inheritance. And this may not, in our so-called enlightened times, sound shocking, but in the Middle East, in their culture, it has far more significance. If you ever read anything by a theologian called Ken Bailey, who I'd highly recommend to you, he spent 15 years in the Middle East, he's lived his life in the Middle East, but spent 15 years particularly asking people in North Africa and the Middle East about the way Jesus tells the story of a son requesting his inheritance from his father while he's still alive. And this was really a distillation of how typically that conversation would run. Has anyone ever made such a request in your village? Never. Could anyone ever make such a request? Impossible. If anyone did, what would happen? His father would beat him, of course. Why? This request means he wants his father to die. And there's no law or custom in Jewish or Arab culture which entitles the son to a share of his father's wealth while the father's still alive. So you can see one instance already where the father is breaking the norms. And Jesus relates, doesn't he, in the story, he divides the inheritance between the two sons. So both sons get their inheritance at that time. The younger son takes his, sells it, sells all the property for cash, goes off, riotous living, and on the point of starvation and utter ruin, he comes to his senses and says, time to eat humble pie and go back home. So he, as we read, prepares a return speech. What am I going to say to my dad? With the aim of confessing his waywardness and thinking, well, there's no chance I'm going to be restored back to the family, but maybe my dad would let me back as a servant. But unbeknown to him, his father had been watching and waiting for his return. He kind of knew, I think. And one day he sees him in the distance coming towards the village. And instead of just waiting to watch and observe him, he picks up his robe and runs to him. Now, to quote Aristotle, great men never run in public. That was the cultural norm in the Middle East. If you imagine two in a robe, you'd have to lift it up and make yourself really unseemly. It was very demeaning, very debasing for a man to lift up his robe and run. So here, for a second time, the father is breaking the cultural norm out of a love for his son. And then we read next, the father's hug and embrace kind of renders the son speechless, doesn't it? So the prepared speech he got is nullified and redundant. And maybe the son just begins to understand that any new relationship with his father has to be a pure gift for which he can offer no solution himself. And then the third instance of the father breaking the cultural norms of the day is when he tells his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. Now, the best robe would almost certainly have been the father's robe. And it was a robe that the father would wear on feast days and banquets. And as the local community would have been arriving at the party, the father instigates a celebration and all the guests would realize that the son wearing the father's robe is a sign of his acceptance of him. The ring is a sign of trust. The shoes, he's a free man in his father's house. So the father has facilitated the son's total restoration. There was nothing the son could do about it. And as we know, too, there's a second son involved, isn't there? There's the older brother. He hears the sound of partying and asks one of the servants, what's going on? And he tells him that his brother's come home. And rather being happy, he's furious. And his father comes out and pleads with him. And we read, rather than saying nice things to his father, he says, look, these many years I've served you. I've never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I may celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, note he doesn't refer to him as his brother, he just says, when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. And what does his father say in response? He says, son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours. The older son had the inheritance, but he wasn't living in it. And we see, I think metaphorically, and physically we see in the first instance a father literally running to the son. I think in this instance we see a father metaphorically running to the older son. So a picture of a father running to be identified, to embrace his sons. Whatever they've done, he's there as a father. And how can we hope to address the events that we've witnessed in the UK in the last 3 months? Well, simply that God doesn't remain distant from us in our human suffering. He became part of it himself, didn't he? He sent his son. God sent his son. God made man. And in effect, as I was just musing and praying on that this week, it's just a picture of the Father, in effect, running to us, sending his son to this earth to run to us. And when Jesus was asked in Luke chapter 13, where the Galileans who'd been murdered by Pilate were worse sinners and therefore and so suffered in that way, he said, no. He then went on to say, or those 18 on whom the Tower of Siloam fell and killed them. No, I tell you. Jesus watched Mary weep over Lazarus. And he indeed wept himself, didn't he? And the Bible too tells us that God will wipe away every tear from our eyes. Now we usually wipe our own tears away, don't we? Why do we do that? Because the eye is probably one of the most sensitive parts of our body. And if we wipe someone else's tear away, we'll probably poke them in the eye. But God's tenderness is such that we can trust him to do that. That intimate thing that God will wipe away every tear from our eyes. We can trust him to do it. He's the running father running to his children. So do I trust him as father this evening? Am I willing to be found by him? I think if Harvey could just put up a slide of a very, very well-known painting. For us, this is Holman Hunt's Light of the World. There's one of the three originals in Keble College Chapel in Oxford. And if you know the picture from Revelation chapter 3, verse 20, Jesus saying, behold, I stand at the door and knock. We know where the handle is, don't we? Where's the handle? It's on the inside. So are we trusting the Lord this evening that we can open the door to him and welcome him in? All we have to do is open the door. I think that's a brilliant example that Jesus is there. We just need to open the door to him. And similarly, to look at another painting, this is another painting that has really was a point of healing to me. Laura was saying that she grew up without a father. My dad died when I was 5. So it's been, and still is, a journey of God's healing and restoration in understanding just what a father's love and who a father is to me. And this is Rembrandt's painting of the return of the prodigal son. You can see the father there in the red robe on the left of the picture. And Henry Nouwen, who's a writer you may have read, spent days in St. Petersburg looking at this painting in the gallery there. And he draws the fact, if you look at the hands of the father, you can see that they look very different. And if you look at the father's left hand, looking strong and holding the son securely and assuredly, yet his right hand looks much more tender, soft and refined. And that's the love of God, tender but strong. And Henry Nouwen writes, he said, I'm beginning now to see how radically the character of my spiritual journey will change when I no longer think of God as hiding out and making it as difficult as possible for him to find, for me to find him. But instead, as the one who's looking for me, while I'm doing the hiding. And the younger son's invitation to the celebration meal is an invitation to intimacy, isn't it? To unconditional love from his father. He allowed himself to be found. And in closing, I just want to give an illustration of two other people who've also been found, allowed themselves to be found by Jesus. One is a lady called Sarah. She's a senior lecturer in Western Sydney University in Australia. And she writes this in terms of a testimony. She says, "One Sunday, shortly before my 28th birthday, I walked into a church for the first time as someone earnestly seeking God. Before long, I found myself overwhelmed. At last, I was fully known and seen, and I realized unconditionally loved. Perhaps I had a sense of relief from no longer running from God. It's God running to her. A friend of mine gave me C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, and one night, after a couple of months attending church, I knelt in my closet and asked in my apartment and asked Jesus to save me and to become the Lord of my life. The love of God was unlike anything which I expected or of which I could make sense. In becoming fully human in Jesus, God behaved decidedly unlike a God. Why deign to walk through death's dark valley or hold the weeping limbs of lepers if you're God? Why submit to humiliation and death on a cross in order to save those who hate you? God suffered punishment in our place because of a radical love. This sacrificial love is utterly opposed to the individualism, consumerism, exploitation and objectification of our culture. To live as a Christian is a call to be part of this new radical creation. I'm not passively awaiting a place in the clouds. I'm redeemed by Christ. So now I have work to do." And I think as you just listen to her testimony, there's a sense there of love and acceptance that's palpable, that's tangible. She's no longer running away, but was willing to be found. And then the second person was Eric Liddell, who you remember from the 1920... Well, you probably won't remember it unless you're approaching 100. But he won the 440 yards, now 400 metres, of course, gold medal in the 1924 Olympics. And if you remember the story, he was originally selected in the Great Britain team to run the 100 yards. I nearly said 100 metres, but it was 100 yards then. But because the final was being held on a Sunday, he opted out and said, "I can't do it." So he was re-entered, or not re-entered, he entered the 440-yard competition. Let's just take a look at that final now. Let's travel back to 1924. Any sound, Holly? Do you want to just run it again, if we can get the sound?
Says in the old book, "He that honors me, I will honor." Good luck, Jackson Shores. So where does the power come from? To see the race to its end from within. Jenny, I believe God made me for a purpose. But he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure.
It says in the old book that he who honors me, I will honor. And Little goes on to say, "Jenny, I believe God made me for a purpose." I mean, you heard that. "He also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure." Little was a man who'd allowed himself to be found by God. Are we willing to be found by him this evening? Will we allow ourselves to see the Father running to us, to embrace us?